Do you or someone you love wish you had a better job? Want to be happier on your current job? Don't even have a job? Welcome to Work with Marty Nimco.
Well, it's always a pleasure about the once every 5 weeks when I have my wife, Dr. Barbara Nimco, with me to be a two for the price of one source of answers to your questions, source of debate, thorn in my side, stress. Dr. Barbara Nimco, welcome. First of all, let me say hello. Are you there? Okay. Are you there, Barbara?
Yeah.
Oh, good. Very good. Okay. So you attended a conference recently called ISTE, International Society for Technology and Education, and you've heard so many keynote speeches, you're usually kind of, iffy about most of them, but you came home exuberant about this one. The guy's name was Michio Kaku, and that gave me the idea of trying to interview him, and I got to interview him for my Psychology Today article. And I was wondering if you had any questions for me about my talk with Kaku. I talked to him for 2 hours. Anything career-related you might be curious about?
Absolutely. I found his talk fascinating because he is a physicist, and yet he can speak in terms that ordinary people who are not necessarily scientists can understand. Mm-hmm. And what he was talking about to the ISTE audience was, how do we prepare our kids for the jobs that we can't even imagine are going to exist, and so many of them will be in science.
Yeah.
And so my question, since you talked to him in great detail, mm-hmm. would be, if you had fiat power, what would your first edict be to better prepare the next generation for the science-centric world that they are going to inherit?
Right. I certainly did ask him that. And he was extremely critical of education. He said that the thing he'd really do, I gave him a broader question. I asked him, what would he change about anything related to the science-centric world? And he said he would absolutely transform science education. He said that he thought that science education does a great job of training people for the world of 1950, but a terrible job of preparing people for today's world, let alone tomorrow. And he cited something that we've all said again and again, but the educators just don't like to face it, that American students score near the dead bottom, not just for 1 year, but for the last, since they started doing this testing. American students scored near dead bottom. Those are his words, near dead bottom among developed nations. And not just in science, but in reading and in math. And then Shanghai, China scores number one. He didn't want to talk about cultural differences, of course, but he talked about, he said, we need to change education. He said, we need less memorization. And it was really interesting. He said to me, he said, I never memorized the periodic table of the elements. This guy is a physicist. He says, I've never used it. He says, I can look that up. And he said, in the future, we're going to blink. And we're going to see in our contact lenses the periodic table. The word he used was very powerful. He said, by teachers continuing to force kids to learn stuff like the periodic table, he uses the word crushes them. And it makes sense. It's so damn boring. I mean, there are some people who are little goody-goodies, and they're conformists. They'll do whatever it takes to get an A. But especially if we're concerned about closing the achievement gap, the people who are at the bottom of the achievement gap are not going to be the goody-goodies who are going to sit there and memorize the periodic table. It's going to, as Kaku said, crush them. He said we need to be focusing more on active involvement. Of course, that makes me puke because we've been saying active involvement in learning for the last 50 years. He said, the quote that it was really, he said, we need less tuning forks, less pulleys, less friction formulas. He says students know they're never going to use that. They need more study of outer space, DNA. They need more exciting teaching instead of the dull teaching that, there are some great teachers. I'm not tarring with a broad brush, but there's a lot of, especially in science and math, which are the less verbal careers, very often there are former scientists and mathematician types who end up going into math, and they're not the most scintillating communicators. And he was very tough. He said that both students and teachers need more feedback. He said, and this is pretty much a quote, he said, it would help if we stopped protecting bad teachers. He said, it's very difficult to get rid of even sexual pervert teachers, let alone just plain bad teachers. And he finally, the final thing he said is, he says, you know, education seems to careen from one fad to another and back again. He says there's a need for an enduring, robust theory of education. Too often, and now I'm adding my own phrase, too often social science is ideology, but they wrap itself up in statistics to make it look like science. But it really is ideologically driven rather than real science. And that's what he said about education for the next generation.
May I agree, disagree, and amplify?
Of course, like always.
Okay. Well, for starters, I would disagree with his point that we are doing a good job of preparing students for the science world of the 50s. We weren't even doing a good job then. The way in which I was taught science was guaranteed to turn off most kids, which was, here's a book, open the book, read the chapter, answer the questions. This does not generate enthusiasm about the entire field of science. It was the same as what we did in history. So we never did a good job. Science should be fascinating because you have variables, and as you change the variable, you get a different result. This would be interesting to kids, but we didn't know how to do that. And typically, in the 50s, when I went to school, most elementary school teachers were women, and they went into teaching, and this is a broad brush, but many of them were not interested in science, and so they gave it short shrift. And the curriculum has always emphasized reading and math way more than science and history. So there are a million reasons why kids were not excited about science. Today, we are moving to a more active, engaging, problem-solving, exploring kind of curriculum, which is changing the way we are teaching science, not as quickly as we'd all like, but kids are working to solve problems. And with digital, and remember this, the conference that I was at was about the transformation to a digital world, you can use virtual reality to go in. You can go into outer space, you can go underwater, you can go into the body, you can see digestion actually occurring, you can see peristalsis. You're not reading about it. So we are on the brink of really transforming what we're doing. We have a whole new generation of teachers who are ready, willing, and able to take us into a more active, engaging world.
I want to disagree with both of you. I think, if you know, tying this back to career, I know scientists. I work with scientists. And in reality, what they really do is they sit in front of computers and they do mathematical and statistical analyses primarily. It is false advertising to seduce kids into thinking, you know, I'm not talking about, you know, general science, fine, let's just get them to appreciate the wonders of the world. But two things. Number one, the reality of science, not in 1950, where we were studying little fuzzy animals and how cute they are and whatever, and save the species.
I never studied that. I would have liked that.
Yeah. What is real scientists, and certainly Kako and I discussed this, and he agrees, it's all about the molecules. And molecules are about math and vectors and physics and in spreadsheets and big data analysis and multiple regression analysis and Bayesian statistics. It has nothing to do with this macro cool stuff about looking into the stars and being aware of the wonder of it, or looking at the environment, or even, and now here's where you're going to really get annoyed at me. I don't think all of these wonderful real world problem solvings are anything other than a summer camp and playtime, unless people have memorized, yes, the dirty word, memorized, a lot of the facts. Because until you know the basic facts, you're just playing guesswork around everything. You need to know the substance. And the reason why we don't do this and why we are pandering to students is because we believe that they won't be motivated unless we make it very, very sugar-coated. I really think the word that may be most absent in today's society, in the workplace and in the schools, is the word discipline. The point that not everything is supposed to be easy, and that if you're going to accomplish something, you need to discipline to do things that are not cool, interesting, and going to be on your Nintendo, but to indeed memorize some of those things. I remember learning, really knowing, and I still to this day know, for example, the multiplication tables up to 35. Now, you would think, why the hell do I need to know that? What
up
it
to
did
35?
Was...
35?
Yep. But why...
How much is 9 times 35?
Well, it happens to be 315. But the issue really is whether it is important to value discipline in and unto itself. And we're wondering why Shanghai, China always finishes number one and America finishes near the bottom of the developed nations. And, you know, there's many factors that go beyond the scope of this show. But one of them certainly is, I remember a dinner that you and I were at. You probably don't remember, but it was a very important conversation where it was a woman from China who was at the table with us. And she was a teacher or something. And I asked her about the differences between education in here and in China. And she says that we make kids memorize the letters of the alphabet. We make them memorize a tremendous amount because that's prerequisite to really fully understanding it. I understand math, the relationship among numbers, because I completely memorized all the times tables. I began to get a sense of number and the relationship and what happens when you do add a number, when 9 times 35 versus 8 times 35. I have an intrinsic, in my fabric, understanding of number. And I think that unless we do that and we simply let kids play with problems, that real world problem solving that we don't understand, when we don't understand the facts, it's just we're being silly. We're being like astrologers. And so I think the answer may really ultimately be in getting kids and adults to, instead of in praise of creativity, in praise of rebelling against authority and against rote memory, instead recognizing that discipline is the prerequisite. A great pianist doesn't become a great pianist simply by being creative. He or she, whether it's a screenwriter or a pianist, knows the craft. The craft that they know in their gut, and then only then can they impose their creativity. I know that's a wildly unacceptable thought in the year 2016, but Barbara, what is your honest reaction?
I think you explained perfectly why the pianist needs to practice all the scales. That's true, because he wants to be a pianist. And I think the person who wants to be a scientist absolutely is going to need the discipline. But when we start out looking at science, making kids just memorize random things that they can look up doesn't make any sense at all, because most kids are not going to grow up to be scientists. Some will, some won't. I think part of our problem is we try to impose the requirements for being the head of the profession when we're just starting to get kids excited about what the profession is all about. And just straight memorization is not what I would recommend as what you do as the first thing. I think it is exciting for kids to see the potential for science, to, in the elementary school, be learning about the processes of the body, and that can be cool and it can be fun and it can be exciting to talk to a doctor on Skype or in person about symptoms that a patient has and then try to research and figure out what body systems are involved and what kinds of things might be causing the problem and how you could fix it. Later on, if they decide they want to be doctors, for those select students who want to, there's all kinds of stuff they're going to have to memorize, but that doesn't mean I'm going to impose it on the fifth grade class.
I partly agree and partly disagree. I certainly agree that we need to infuse in everyone a sense of awe, and there's room for pleasure. But as we have said many times on this show, there is no need to teach everybody quadratic equations. So I fully agree, because even most professionals don't use it. That said, what is one of the... I do believe that it is important for young kids to learn discipline. That is, the willingness to work hard and long at that which is not fun. And so both because of teaching of discipline, and even at the level where you are trying to get kids in groups to solve problems. Let's say they're trying to come up with a solution to water pollution or whatever. If they're just shooting from the hip, it's summer camp. It's just shooting from the hip. That's not the kind of rigorous critical thinking that we say is so important and analytical. I would rather have my kids have a foundation of understanding the basics of chemistry, not the fun parts, but the basics of chemistry, the basics of math, the basics of physics, so that they can have a more informed conversation even at the high school level. Because otherwise, we're giving them the message that all they need to do to have a seat at the table and make, quote, policy, which half of my clients want to do, is shoot from the hip and have their soundbite bumper sticker rhetoric is enough. What's needed is rigorous critical thinking informed by the real, not fun, scientific and mathematical principles. And that's where I think the pendulum has gone bizarrely in favor of creative thinking and your opinion is as good as my opinion. No.
Oh, there I totally agree with you. But if a child can take a sample of this pond water that's polluted, and then they can try various treatments on and then keep testing it to see which of the treatments is going to work, would that be the kind of science that you're talking about?
No, because there's two versions. I want that experiment, yes. But there's, let's say we clone two classes. One class is just trial and erroring to see what effects we could do to purify the water. And the other has a foundation of the basic boring science and math that will enable them to make more informed guesses about what's likely to purify our water.
Why are you assuming that we're going to just randomly throw kids in without teaching them something about which of these things might work to purify the water and now let's test it out?
But if we tell them which of the few things might work, then they're not doing any development or critical thing. Then it's just cookbook. It's like following the cookbook. Well, you know, if you really try this compound, it's going to purify the water.
You today?
What? Well, I'm doing my best.
If I teach them some things that would possibly work to purify water, and then we test them out to see which ones work best, You didn't like that either. If I don't teach them things, it's wild creativity.
No.
If I teach them too much, then it's cookbook.
Well, let me explain.
So
it's in between. Well, if I'm teaching you saying that these are chemicals that might purify water better, I am not letting them develop the thinking process to develop. I want them to figure out which compound is more likely to purify the water based on the understanding of science. If I simply tell them, it's like giving them a cookbook. It's saying, okay, you can make these scones by mixing this amount of flour with this amount of water. There's no critical thing. It's merely following directions. If I say, here are some general principles of science, here are ways in which chemicals can interact to become neutral instead of acid or base, now, in light of that principle that you've now, it's a boring principle, now, let's see if you can figure out which of these 20 chemicals is most likely to create, instead of an acidic or a basic water, a neutral one. There's a world of difference.
What age would you do that?
I think probably kids are able on a very concrete level to start that at what Piaget would call the pre-formal operations level, probably 9, 10, 11, something like that, and maybe 12. Something like that. But let's turn back to the career. Let's let our listeners know. I think this is an interesting conversation because this is very, very foundational to what career success is, except at the lowest levels. There are many careers that are indeed going to require robotic, literally or figuratively, following directions. But the jobs that are not going to be offshoreable or certainly not automatable are going to be those that require the ability to control variables, to think hard about what's really causal, to make your recommendations when you have a seat at the table based on a rigorous analysis, not shoot from the hip. And so this conversation about how education should occur has implications both for education, which in the long run affects career, but also is perhaps a useful wake-up call for thinking why you are not having a seat at the table at the higher levels and getting good pay, and why your children and grandchildren, if they are too, especially in a world of ever greater automation, need to focus on that critical thinking and analysis and synthesis and less shooting from the hip.
Well, I totally agree with that. So let's leave that part and let me ask you another question.
But let's let our listeners know what you're listening to. You're listening to Work with Marty Nemco and Barbara Nemco. And as you know, sometimes, and we will in just a few minutes, we will go to the phones and take your very practical questions about how to solve your work problems. But we like to think that the show would be narrow-minded if we just focused on the tactical, what to do now. We like to look at the big picture issues relating to career and the workplace, as well as the micro. And that's what we're doing right now, because I had the privilege of interviewing for 2 hours Michio Kaku, arguably the world's most famous science popularizer and theoretical physicist, and he spent a lot of time talking with me about what would be the biggest change he would make related to science, and he would transform science education, and that would be preliminary to improving our workforce competency to survive in the global economy. You wanted to ask me one other question from that two-hour interview I had with Kaku.
I do. And that would be, to date, technology advances have created more jobs than they eliminated. And that was one of his main premises. But many people worry that in today's information age and tomorrow's molecular age, with all the progress that we're seeing in robots' capability, that this time the technology advances will be different. They won't create more jobs than they eliminate. They may eliminate more jobs than they create. What do you think?
Here is another example of where we disagreed. What he said was he thought that still computers and robots are still basically adding machines. They're only able to do things where all the variables are controlled in advance and programmed into the computer and very predictable. He pointed out correctly that robots aren't great at pattern recognition. They certainly don't have common sense. That's why a computer can beat a human being in chess, but can't even have a basic conversation with a six-year-old.
Well, with a six-year-old, a lot of us can't have a basic conversation.
That's true, especially if they've been spoiled and to interrupt at all times. But anyway, and to do whatever they want. But I argued back with him, and I said, that sounds, frankly, you're the futurist, but it sounds old-fashioned. I've been reading about Pepper, the robot. Already in Europe, it is doing hospital reception. And they can read, this robot can read whether people are happy or sad or angry and respond appropriately. Compare that with the average human being who may, you know, who's a receptionist, may not be that interpersonally sensitive and certainly may not be reliable, show up every day. And after you pay for the cost of the robot, you're not paying, living wage and benefits and whatever. So I told him that I worry tremendously that, except for the most cognitively complex jobs, and I did buy the MIT research that said last year, 2 years ago, that said that half of jobs are going to be remote, are going to be automated, from retail clerks, as we're seeing now in Target and in Osh. There are robotic retail people who will tell you exactly how much inventory something where it is and where it is, and you'll put your screw or whatever you want to replace into the thing, and it'll read it. And then there's already Hilton hotels are using concierges that are automated because they're more reliable and less corruptible than the concierge who's being bought off by some restaurant. And driverless vehicles, and now they've got a robotic nurse called Sophia that was just showed at a big conference that it's got a tremendous amount of medical knowledge, more than the average nurse can have, and it certainly, for starters, going to work alongside nurse. But I really do worry. But he pushed back. He said that there's really just, it's still a long way from when you can really read language and emotions well. So that was our little debate.
Oh, very interesting. So many implications for so many things.
Yep, absolutely. And I think sometimes we all view the world. You're constitutionally an optimist. I'm constitutionally a mild pessimist. So I'm always, I remember or I hear all of the stories about how robots and offshoring are going to replace jobs, and maybe I'm not, it's what's called confirmation bias. Maybe I'm not sufficiently open to the many jobs that won't. I want you, before we capstone this and do go to the phones, I want you to get the last word. One of my biggest worries is the decline of good jobs for the, not the NPR listeners, but for the 50% of people who have IQs under 100 who really have a hard time just dealing with the basics of life. So much of that, as Kaku said, is going to be automated. I worry tremendously about them. I'd like you to provide a counterbalance to that pessimism. Say something that's realistic but optimistic about the future of the world of jobs for our children, for ourselves, for our children and our grandchildren.
Well, I'm not sure I can. I think certainly service jobs people are always going to need people. They're not always going to want to just have a robot around. And with people living longer, there will be so many more jobs in the health careers. Some of them will be done by robots, but many of them, if you look at the technological advances, are still done by doctors using robotic arms, but it's still the doctors who are controlling the arms. And the difference is that they're doing a much better job of the surgery because the robots are more precise than a human being can ever be.
Yeah.
So I think because there will be so many more people living to longer and longer ages, there will be a lot more jobs in all the areas that revolve around the geriatric population.
Yeah, and Joanne Marr agrees with you. She just wrote a little note here. She said, machinery is not, underlined, infallible. It breaks down all the time. Would you trust a driverless car if it could stop functioning at any time? The way I would answer that would be, in order to make an omelet, you've got to break eggs. And we are certainly only in the very earliest stage. We now don't think twice about the reliability of machines like ATMs or automatic checkouts or automatic toll takers or, anyway, those are good examples. And so, of course, we could look, you know, here's where I'm a techno-optimist. We can always look at this. We are at the earliest test stages. It's not even commercially available. One car was apparently, it misread some sign and it stopped or didn't stop. Misread a truck or whatever.
As the sky.
Right. And, of course, all of these things, like from drone delivery on to the automated nurses, they're going to be failures. And if we let the failures stop us, I think we will ultimately do us a disservice. I think very few of us long for the day when we had to wait in line to see the teller to get our bank transaction, and we're relieved that we can go in and we can simply put our card in and with no wait and get our money out and put our money in and see our balances and everything. So I would argue for a little patience here and here to be a little bit of a techno-optimist, not a techno-dreamer, where we think that technology has all the answers, because there are downsides to technology, including the jobs thing. But I think that those errors that make the headlines are, you know, is I think another example of journalists playing gotcha. And I think we need to be a little more patient, because ultimately I think we reap many more rewards. So
I don't think anybody was suggesting that we stop doing the research necessary to have driverless cars that will not misread important signals. I think it just made many of us pause and say, well, maybe I'm not quite ready to aspire to a driverless car this year.
And on that, you and I could not agree more. So now is a good time to make transition to hopefully helping real individual people. So if you, dear listeners, have a work problem of any sort, whether you're unemployed or very well employed and still unhappy, one of the most vivid memories of my life is I have a client who is a billionaire with a B, and he made his money ethically, and yet he has 45 Nembutal pills next to his bed every night. Nembutal is an animal tranquilizer that's a way of apparently very peacefully committing suicide. He's very, very depressed about everything in his life, despite he's a billionaire. So whether you are unemployed or you are very well employed, whether you're 16 or 76, if you have any sign of work problem, either in your current job or you don't know what you want to be when you grow up, even if you're already 40, 50, 60, I welcome your call, and you get two for the price of one, zero price, two people, Barbara Nemco and Marty Nemco here at Work with Marty Nemco. The phone number here for what we call a workover, no pummeling involved, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And Barb, while we're waiting for the calls to come in, we've gotten letters from readers, listeners, etc., over the years. And do you want to read one? And I'll try to take a shot at.
I would be delighted.
Okay.
Dear Marty, I play guitar in a wedding band. I've played over 1,000 weddings in the last decade. I used to love it, making good music, and getting to eat great meals. It was a great job. Now it's feeling empty. I don't want to go to my grave thinking my greatest contribution is having played wedding songs, especially when half the happy couples, no matter how lavish the wedding, end up divorced, often with a legal battle that cost more than the wedding did. And these days, at the cost of weddings, that's a legal battle. I'm ready for a divorce from wedding gigs. I want to transition into some new career, but have no idea what, which is why I'm writing to you. I think I want a career outside of music. I know I'd like to work with my head rather than my hands, but I'd like to avoid going back to school, except maybe for a year or less, of training that would definitely lead to a career. I want a secure middle-class income, doesn't everybody? Any careers that I should consider? Weddinged out in Washington.
First of all, not everybody does want to. You know, there are many people who enjoy the, we'll call it bohemian lifestyle, who like the flexibility of being able to do a temp gig now and then travel for 3 months and do another one, and they're willing to live modestly. And I kind of have a lot of respect for those people. But yes, most people do want a secure middle-class existence, without any question. So he's asked a very open-ended question. So I'm just going to throw out some careers that don't require. His challenge was he wants to use his head rather than his hands, and he doesn't want to go back to school for a long time. So I'll throw out a few careers that I think are likely to lead to a middle-class living that don't require a lot of school. And one is starting as a bookkeeper. You can learn quite quickly the basics of bookkeeping using QuickBooks, a quick course online or self-taught or whatever, and then little by little take some more courses and become an accountant. Because that's one thing. We know that the tax laws are not going to get simpler. We know that the taxes, if anything, are going to get higher. And so it's pretty important. You know, it's a skill that, again, it's not sexy, and so it's always going to be in much more demand than, saying, being an activist, which is fun and exciting, feels like it's changing the world, but there's a lot of people who want to be activists. There's a hell of a lot fewer people who want to be bookkeepers. So if you're looking for a stable middle-class income, as this guy said, without a lot of school, bookkeeping is one. Another is non-retail sales. Retail sales is crappy. You got to work nights, you got to work weekends, the pay is crap. But if you are selling products to businesses, there's usually higher profit margin. It's less sexy. People don't know about it as much. And so you're more likely to get paid well. And, you know, there are plenty of salespeople who make six-figure incomes. And at the risk of typical being a public radio, you know, pious pontificator, I really think that sleazy sales is one of the worst things you could do. But if you can take the time to find a product that you believe in that is either great because of its better quality or its innovation or simply because it's cheaper and does almost as good a job, selling that kind of product to business, whether it be industrial machinery or, yes, pollution control devices or some techno thing that businesses use or whatever, that can be, and that doesn't require, again, a lot of school, and it is mainly using your head. It's good problem solving because a good salesperson is listening very carefully to the problems that that business is facing. And if you have the critical thinking skills that we were discussing earlier, that's going to be the high pay kind of sales job, and that can, you'll feel ethical and can make really good money and won't require a lot of school. I'll give one more before we go to the phones. And that is, ever fewer people are able to afford a home now. And so there are ever more people either renting condos or buying condos, smaller condos. There's more shared living spaces. And so property management is something that is going to continue to grow, in my judgment. And so somebody who's a condominium association manager or an apartment house property manager, you don't have to be somebody who's a fix-it person. You're more likely somebody who can just, pardon the cliche, bring the community together for, you know, to come up with ideas, to make the condominium development or the apartment thing better, to resolve conflicts. I think that's going to be another career that's not going to require a lot of school. We'll end up paying quite a bit, because if you've got a 15 or 30 unit apartment complex or condominium complex, there's a lot of money at stake. And so I think that's an under-the-radar career that could provide a stable middle-class income, feeling completely ethical without a lot of school.
I want to throw in another one.
Yes, please.
My recent personal experience.
Great.
When I injured my already partially torn rotator cuff, mm-hmm. I found myself in excruciating pain, mm-hmm. and paid a visit to my favorite physical therapist in Napa, Bruce McCall, who's a miracle worker. Now, he quickly diagnosed the problem, but it was physical therapy aides, mm-hmm. who actually did the treatment, There was a water treatment and a sonar treatment, and they were fabulous. I don't know what kind of salaries physical therapy aides make, but what a nice job to take people from pain to feeling good in a short period of time.
There's actually three levels. There's the physical therapy, physical therapist, and that's a three-year doctorate. And there are the aides that you mentioned, and they're very low pay and low trained. But there's a middle ground. They're called physical therapy assistants. And I'm very bullish on that career because as we are going to be, we will no doubt have single payer, in my judgment, in the Hillary Clinton administration. We will therefore have a hell of a lot more people who are going to be covered. And the most of those new people are not going to be paying much into the system. So as we're already seeing that, for example, dentist work in many areas is now getting shunted down to a lower level called dental assistant, dental associates, or whatever they're called. We're seeing it in physical therapy as well, so that the physical therapist is going to do less and less work, only the more complicated, and the physical therapy assistants who have shorter training, but still they're going to be doing a lot of the responsible thinking level work, that's going to be the career that I think is going to pay the middle class living and not require as much school.
Well, I think that would be a great job, and certainly, again, with the aging population, there's going to be greater and greater need for that kind of work.
I absolutely agree. And now, I'll give out the phone number again. If you or someone you care about has got a work-related problem, the phone number here, Work with Marty Nemko, for what we call a workover with Barbara Nemko and Marty Nemko, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Let's go to the phones. Welcome to the show. It's your turn on the air. How can we help?
I really appreciate your show. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
The reason I'm calling is I am a person, I'm in my mid-50s, and I recently, I'm gainfully employed in a career that has been and continues to be somewhat rewarding, but I am someone who highly values continuous learning, and I'm really interested in exploring some possible new directions for the last chapter of my working years. And I recently completed a master's in recreation and tourism management, which was a remarkably satisfying and rather fabulous experience, kind of much to my surprise in some ways. It was lovely. And so what I'm looking for now is I've got potentially some, potentially some new opportunities out there of looking at how to combine my extensive nonprofit management and leadership background with the new field that I've studied at the master's level. So I was interested in exploring that a little bit and just seeing what your take on that was. I think especially in light of what you were just discussing with the last caller of the baby boomers retiring and again, continuous learning. I think people are more interested in, I think this generation maybe, those of us in this generation may be more interested in having an educational component in our retirement years.
Okay. So there's a few things that come to mind. Was your nonprofit experience specifically related to a particular, quote, underserved community?
No, but I'm interested. Well, in a way, yes. I work in animal welfare, so I guess you could say that the clients, the animals, are underserved.
Okay.
And we are expanding in the role that I'm in, which is very satisfying. As I said, we're expanding our reach into that community. I work in the veterinary aspect of it, veterinary medical care, making that available to underserved populations. Which is lovely. I mean, again, I don't have a major complaint with my current profession. I'm just looking for, I'm always looking at, at ways to combine
okay.
and learn, continue to learn and grow. So underserved populations are of interest to me. And in my master's degree, the social justice class was, frankly, one of the things that I got really fired up about.
Okay. So is there a particular... a particular, quote, underserved population that moves you? Is it older people? Is it African Americans? Is it transgender people? Is it intellectuals? Is it developmentally disabled? Is it women? Is there a particular group that moves you or no?
Some of those that you mentioned are interesting to me. I think that the way I view that is the recreation aspect and to a degree tourism. What interested me about that field is that there are many underserved populations that don't have equal access to recreational opportunities, and I'm interested in that.
Okay. So are we talking about, that could be either of two things. It could either be local, let's say, for example, I remember 20 years ago when they felt that the key to helping African Americans was to expose them to tennis and golf. So, you know, is it like that kind of thing, or is it more helping older citizens to do senior-friendly travel to underserved countries, to where we could, you know, do redistributive justice to Africa and provide more money to Africa? So you take seniors to Africa on a let's say, a disabilities-friendly tours to Africa as a way of combining your tourism with your activism. Either of those feel like you?
Potentially. I'm not certain right at this moment.
Okay, we'll keep playing. So, you know, when I think of recreation, you're more into the recreation or the hotel or hospitality, or what aspect of the recreation and tourism piece is of interest to you?
Education. Learning.
Okay. So, if you were to develop working for a company that either, you had two choices, doing education tours for underserved people and getting government grants for that, or would you rather work for Pause for Healing, which is a nonprofit that helps seniors pair up with animals for companionship and as they age? Which of those feels more like you?
Both of those would be interesting to me.
Okay. Barbara, do you want to add anything, or should I ask her another question? Barbara?
Yeah, I'm going to ask her another question. I do not have anything to add to that.
Oh, you don't? Okay. Fine. So if I put a gun to your head and I had...
Whose head are you putting the gun to?
No, it's going to be one of those guns. You know how in the comedies they point a gun and out comes, like a little flag that says ha-ha or something like that. So it's that kind of gun. But we had to choose something. Would you be focusing more on, you know, of all the things we've talked about, which most resonates? We'll build from that.
God, I wish I had a quick answer for you, and I hope the gun's not loaded.
It's definitely not.
So I guess what I'm looking for, so the other piece that I really love in my work that I would like more of, the social science research aspect that I enjoyed about pursuing my master's, was I really like organizational development. I think organizational culture matters, and I enjoy participating in making that kind of change, especially in nonprofits, which I think can be extremely dysfunctional places to work.
So here's where I'm headed for the end of today's conversation. There are organizations that exist that are roughly in your space. The Osher Center for Learning is for older. It's called OLLI, O-L-L-I. You can Google it.
Okay.
It's associated with UC
Thank
Berkeley.
You.
And what they do is they provide a whole range of courses and trips and whatever for older people. And given you say you like the research, you like the continuous learning, you keep coming back to the education thing, I'm wondering whether organizations like that serve older people to educate them might be a focus where you could find a job in the organization. Somehow, you know, organizational development just basically means you like the idea of working within an organization to improve the culture, manage, maybe help spearhead some new initiatives. You know, again, if you've got the nonprofit vibe and values, not vibe, but values, you know, you might, you know, just focus your efforts, you know, in trying to get a job there and working on providing more, you know, right now OLLI serves primarily fairly wealthy people who can afford to pay tuitions to UC Berkeley. But maybe you would want to get a job in there. And once you got in there in organizational development or management or something like that, you might come up with some initiative, maybe not by yourself, with other people, that would provide either underserved things or whatever, special travel to serve, maybe visit orphanages in poor countries or Be like a mini Peace Corps. There's all kind. You can go very little. You can go very big. You can simply visit animal shelters across the world for older people, and that would radicalize them to see the inhumane way that perhaps animals are treated in places other than the United States, or certainly other than the Bay Area, where they have these little. The ASPCA in San Francisco has almost like a little hotels where they're cushy paired with televisions in each for all the adoptable doggies. So any of that sound of interest?
Yeah, definitely. And I think along lines what you're saying, I mean, I'm familiar with the organization Rhodes Scholar, and I really find their mission intriguing, but it's exactly like you said, which is that it appeals, well, frankly, to people like me, which
right.
is middle to upper middle class.
But something I'm going to interrupt you. This is something that is a mega trend in society. Societies, if I could reduce the drive, the energy, the vectors, the power, we're moving to a more egalitarian society, to redistributive society, meaning take more from the rich and give more to the have-nots. And so all organizations, if you watch the media or listen to the media, that is the message underneath almost everything you're going to hear. Therefore, even in organizations that currently serve the middle or upper middle class, people whom we call privileged today, although sometimes that privilege is earned, privilege is not just accorded by your race, gender, sexual orientation, but we certainly believe that we need to take more from the middle class and the rich and redistribute. That suffuses every organization, especially a nonprofit. And therefore, even if an organization like Rhodes Scholars is primarily serving well-off people, they are not immune to the meme of society. And therefore, if you come in with your progressive values and say, I want to make Rhodes Scholars programs more available to the poor, to minorities, to the Palestinians, to whomever, you're probably going to get a sympathetic ear. Does that make sense?
Yeah. It does, and I appreciate your time, and that's what I'm looking for is, I guess a more defined roadmap, but I'll work on that myself.
Well, no, but that's where you start. Start with the specific organizations, whether it be like Oli or Rhodes Scholar. Joanne Marr, okay. My engineer, also had a suggestion. I had, among the buffet of options I listed, I talked about the programs that existed, and maybe in the past, maybe they still exist, for having poor kids be exposed to, quote, upper-class sports like golf and tennis. She also said there may indeed be opportunities for various nonprofits. This doesn't, for kids who are, living in where there are these neglected city, areas where they could be converted into active playgrounds instead of, old tot lots that were around. And apparently there are these, and I didn't know about this, this is Joanne's good idea, there are adventure playgrounds in Europe. And maybe if you're interested in kids, you expressed it primarily interested in older people, but if you also have an interest in kids, maybe I'm sure, there's a nonprofit for every cause imaginable here in the Bay Area. Maybe you'd find something that was dealing with recreation for children in, quote, underserved communities. What do you think?
I think it's great. Yeah, no, that definitely interests me.
All
thank
right.
you.
All right, Barbara, before I let her go, is there anything else you wanted to say or ask?
Good luck.
Thanks.
Sounds like a new
thank
adventure.
You.
Okay.
Sounds like what? Sorry?
A new adventure.
Yes, that's what I'm after.
Okay. Thanks a lot for calling the show.
Thank you.
Okay, I'll give out the phone number again. If you or someone you care about has got a work-related problem, we will try to help this, but it's a rare time that Barbara just decided to defer completely to me, but she usually has much to contribute, and so you will get both of us. If you have a work-related problem, the phone number 415-841-4134. What is that? The number for? It's for a workover here on Work with Marty Nemko and KALW. 415-841-4134. Oh, I'm supposed to give the number. 91.7 KALW is what I'm supposed to say, so I will say that. While we're waiting for the calls, Barbara, do you want to read me another letter from from somebody who...
Absolutely. Dear Marty, I have a master's degree in public policy, but after an internship and an entry-level analyst job, I'm left with the feeling that I'm unlikely to be making much policy, which was what motivated me to spend the last 2 years in big bucks on my master's. So when I got laid off from that job, it was funded on soft money. I hate when that happens. I did a lot of thinking, and it occurred to me that I already had a job I loved when I drove a cab when I was in college. I loved talking to all the passengers for short bursts. I had a good sense of direction and loved seeing that meter keep going up. Every few seconds, I had made another 20 cents. So, a few months ago, I started driving a cab again. Of course, now, some of my fares are Uber, so the pay is less, but it's still okay. And my customers love me because I drive quickly but safely, I speak good English, and am educated, so we have good conversations. Yet, if I sense they don't want to talk, I shut up. I get great tips, averaging 25%. I even have regulars, people who specifically request me. My family and friends are telling me that cab driving is dead end and will only get lower paying as Uber grows even more popular. But somehow, I'm just not a long-term planner. I can't make myself worry enough about the long term to quit and do something with more status. Should I?
Well,
I have a thought.
Oh, well, good, please.
On this one.
I love it. Please go ahead.
And my thought is we spend too much time worrying about status. I think about my dad, who spent most of his life as a pharmacist, and it had sufficient status, but it was never anything that he really loved. And after he retired and sat around for a couple of years, he finally had to get out of the house, and he went back to work and got a job as a runner on Wall Street, which is basically a messenger. So you report to work in the morning, and then they give you a message or a package to take somewhere, and you do it, and then you come back and you get the next assignment. And he loved it. He loved the social aspect, just like this Uber driver is saying. He loved the guys that he worked with. And I use guys, I don't know if there were women involved, but the people that he worked with were nice to talk to. He could have breakfast with them, then he could run around the city, then he could come back and have lunch with them, and he liked that job more than his pharmacy job that he'd had his whole life. So here's somebody who's enjoying driving an Uber and a cab. Why worry about the status if he's having a good time?
I couldn't agree more, and I would add not disagree, finally. You know, this is a show where I have disagreed with that. I would simply add that so many people in more prestigious positions, even those, you know, whether it be lawyers or certainly bond traders, but also even people working for nonprofits, you know, the achievement gap is as wide as it's ever been. Problems, we have so many, think of how many people have devoted efforts to try to create better, build better bridges with the Muslim community, and we're seeing that it's very, very difficult. So nonprofits tackle very often the very big problems of society, and they wouldn't have to be nonprofit if these were easy. These are enormously hard problems. Millions of people in many fields have gone to their graves not making that much difference in these prestigious jobs. But in these non-prestigious jobs, where you're not being so bold in terms of what you're trying to change, if I get a cab driver or you get a cab driver who is honest, who doesn't take us driving around far away, and he knows exactly, or she knows exactly how to get there, is sensitive to me interpersonally, and when I want to chat, will chat with me, but who senses when I don't will shut up, I am with 100% guaranteed certitude I am making a small difference in to improve the life of that human being. Multiply that by the thousands of cab fares that I will get in my cab, and add into the fact that I've had a pleasurable experience. I'm doing what I'm naturally good at, let's say in this case of the person who wrote the note, good sense of direction, you know, all the rest of it, like, you know, is interpersonally sensitive. When that person is on his or her deathbed, is it clear that even though he had no status, that he hasn't lived a life better led than many of the more prestigious people who feel, well, we have the status of being able to cocktail party conversation. Oh, yes, I'm an assistant director at this nonprofit, and we're trying to convert neglected city tot lots to interactive playgrounds. Is it really clear? Of course, that sounds more prestigious. Everybody's going, wow, that's cool, versus when I said a cab driver. But is it really clear if we push aside the status, in terms of who's had a better life in terms of impacting the world and having a more pleasurable life, that our cab driver certainly arguably has had a life worth considering? What do you think?
I'm going to agree with that and go further.
Go.
So many jobs that have status are the kinds of jobs that are pretty much 24/7.
Good point.
Not necessarily that you're there 24/7, obviously, but they're always on your mind.
Yep.
You always have homework. You always have concerns.
Yep.
You're interrupted by messages and emails and phone calls at inopportune times. You can't get out of the office at 5 o'clock. You may be there till 7. You come home, you're distracted, you're tired, you're cranky, and your children and your spouse don't get the best of
you. Exactly.
Because all of that goes to your job.
Exactly.
So as an Uber driver or a cab driver or any of the less status jobs, you leave your job when you come home,
yep,
and you are in a better mood and more able to interpersonally be agreeable with the people who supposedly are the ones you care the most about in the world. So I think you're doing more good in terms of your family and your friends than the people who are always worried about what they have to do the next day or didn't do the day before or didn't do quite right.
That's why I care. While I care about workers, I also care about people who are seen as the enemy by so many of that people in power. They don't, when it's 5 o'clock, they are nowhere near done. They work long hours, and they're worrying. And so I have a real place in my heart. I guess maybe every career counselor does, a sense of empathy for everybody, from the CEO down to the clerk. We have almost no time. We have time for one call. Let's go back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko and Barbara Nemko. What's on your mind?
Me?
It is.
Okay. I just want to point out a wonderful exemplary piece for education for the elders, and it's called the Fromm Institute. And it works on a sliding scale basis. It's located in San Francisco at USF with marvelous professors. It's a wonderful, wonderful place.
Spell it, please.
Fromm.
I'm going to let you get off, like Ethan Frome.
Before she goes off, you said education for seniors.
It's continuing education, just like OLE, only it's a lot less because it's a sliding scale institution.
Okay.
Is it in person, online?
Go online, FROMM.org, and you'll get all the information. It's located at USF in San Francisco. Number 5 bus brings you there.
You're very enthusiastic. I appreciate your enthusiasm.
Fun.
Anyway,
oh, yeah, I've been going there, and I recommend it.
Great. Well, love your attitude.
With enthusiasm.
It's wonderful.
Well, thank you very much for the call. We have a total of 1 minute left, so we don't have time for a call, alas. So, Barbara, I just would like you to give you the last word. As you reflect on today's show, what's something, if anything, that maybe you haven't had a chance to say that you would like to say?
I think we all need to reconsider how much status is important and not be pushed by other people's opinion of what we do. If you are doing something that you love and you're making enough money to sustain yourself and your family, don't worry about the fact that someone else thinks your job isn't important enough.
And that's going to extend, of course, to buying. Once you feel you need to buy status, buy in a home in a status neighborhood, buy a Mercedes rather than a new Mercedes rather than an old Toyota, or a Facanable shirt rather than something from Walmart.
Oh, shirt?
It's one of the big sellers at what do you call it, Nordstrom.
Once say that again?
Facanable. So,
Facanable?
Yeah, I think that's it. So,
my.
I know it's a funny name. but every time you make a decision to do that, you're restricting your career freedom. You're restricting because there are so many jobs you'd rather do that have less status, that may do better for the world, you may enjoy more, but you're paying an enormous, you can't afford to do those every time you buy one of those expensive items. Anyway, Barbara Nemko, thanks
Good
very much.
Point.
Okay, that is Work with Marty Nemko and Barbara Nemko for this week. I want to thank my board member, Joanne Marth. Thank you so much, Joanne, for your contributions. Always, always welcomed. And, of course, I thank most of all of you for listening and calling in. Please join me again next Sunday at 11. I will do workovers on callers. And legendary MIT professor Edgar Schein on workplace culture. How do we define it? How do we improve it? Individuals, branding, and his latest book, I love it, Humble Consulting, in which he argues that because certainty of advice is often illusory, the relationship with the client may be the most important thing. Until next Sunday, for Barbara Nemko, this is Marty Nemko, reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.